isn't the thing. If we look at this whole business of the imagination and the rational, the human and the she, what we're looking at really is how to live in balance, how to find a way that enables us to live fully in all sides of ourselves and to connect with all sides of the world. So we think of what we looked at this weekend, really. One of the particular threads of the weekend that came out pretty much out of nowhere, really, was this whole figure of William Sharp, who is also Fiona MacLeod. And one of the things I knew I was going to look at this weekend was that I wanted to look at to revisit the she pack and look at its potential, because when we're gathered physically together there, that we can do that better than when we can do it online, so that there's a good opportunity to play with that a bit. But the other thing I wanted to look at were the hallows of the Grail and the way in which the Grail is this mysterious, shape-shifting object right at the heart of the mystery. But it has a habit of showing up in four particular forms that relate to the four archangels, that relate to phases of energy, that relate to phases of the day, phases of the year, relate to lots of other things as well. So these are these kinds of constellations of meaning and energy. And one of the things I wanted to look at as well was that sense of the union of opposites and the sense of the sun and the daughter of light. And I thought I was going to do that through by looking at the story of Keeluk and Olwen. But in a certain sense, the inner intervened. So if we look at, well, what did happen to me? I'm thinking I've got my noggin, I've got this. And then what literally happened to me is a few minutes before I'm leaving the house on Saturday morning, I just catch sight of the Fiona MacLeod book, Poems and Dramas. And I think, oh, I'll take that with me. That'll be interesting. Not quite knowing why I'm doing it, but it's almost like a hand doing it without me knowing anything about it. And always, you know, what happens to me really when we sit and playing music and I'm getting ready and I'm thinking, and suddenly, well, actually, just slightly before all that, what happens then is a whole sense of, suddenly I had this very strong sense of this figure I think of as Wilfion, who is both Fiona MacLeod and William Sharp, and then of course I realize that, oh, of course these are a literal son and daughter of light fused together, both distinctive in their own way, but also united in a generative enterprise. And what their particular contribution to the tradition has been is to take some of the very old ideas that go out of Irish and Scot-Irish tradition and bring them much nearer to our time. Now there's a little bit of resistance in me to it, because one of the things, much as I love Fiona MacLeod's work, I've never liked the Celtic Twilight approach to this stuff, because it's all mournful, it's all death and disaster, and let's cut our wrists together while listening to some sad harp music. You know, it's got that depressive undertone to it, which I don't think is appropriate for now. But actually, as I kind of stated, I realized, well, actually, yes, that's kind of what you have to travel through. And so something about the energy of loss, which isn't inappropriate to look at in these days. But underneath that, there's something much more dynamic, something much more profound in that sense, that is generative, that actually has power and beauty and grace. And of course, what comes with that teaching really is the sense of the four cities and the four holy objects, and that sort of all came together with the images of the stone circle of the Sheepak. So suddenly it came together in a way that I don't think it quite would have if I had insisted. I could have insisted on, I might have my plan and I was going to do this.
That's well, logical brain, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely was my logical brain trying to wanting to, because I was intending to do, and I've done the reading for it as well, actually. You know, I haven't done any preparation for introducing you to the work of William Shaw. I didn't know it quite well, but I hadn't done any actual reading about it and sort of, but I, you know, if I go in that direction, the real senses of because I could make it happen, but I'd be pushing against the stream as opposed to going with the stream.
And was it something to do with Samhain as well? You said the energy of Samhain as well.
The energy of Samhain is about the ancestors and in a certain sense, you know, William Sharp, Fiona MacLeod are relatively recent ancestors and are showing us a way, you know. So there's something of letting go into all of that, and so what starts to emerge then is this sense of particularly as I start to read the poems and start to think about the play The Immortal Hour. Then something really then starts to happen. These energies of the intention I had really, which is just first to look at the Hallows of the Grail and the Son and Daughter of Light and their union, is absolutely clearly expresses itself, but through a different set of forms than I'd imagined they were going to do so. You know, which is a surprise to me and a kind of and you know, I literally just went with it, you know. It's not uncommon for me to do this. I never quite know what's going to happen when I'm teaching. I sort of, you know, what's going to happen next? I don't know really. We'll have to see.
It's also interesting that The Immortal Hour was performed in Glastonbury.
It was quite recently, yeah. You know, sort of,
and the energy field.
So I guess it's,
and for the first time ever in Glastonbury.
Yes. So I'm going to come back to The Immortal Hour.
I've got to say, before you read anything from The Immortal Hour, I find it the most strange and incomprehensible title.
Well, it's an interesting story. I still partly do myself, but I think there's something interesting in it, and we will no doubt come back to it again somewhere. But I'm going to, before I do that, I just want to reread some of the poems that I read before, because that was the sort of the, if you like, the triggers into this. And one of them is from something called The Little Book of the Great Enchantment, which is again a magical book in fairyland. It doesn't exist anywhere outside the inner worlds. And it begins like this. There are four cities that no mortal eye has seen, but that the soul knows. These are Gorias that is in the east, and Phineas that is in the south, and Murias that is in the west, and Phalias that is in the north. And the symbol of Phalias is the stone of death, which is crowned with pale fire. And the symbol of Gorias is the dividing sword. And the symbol of Phineas is a spear. And the symbol of Murias is a hollow that is filled with water and fading light. And then from an actual book, which is the Fionn Lemclaw's book, The Divine Adventure. Wind comes from the spring star in the east. Fire from the summer star in the south. Water from the autumn star in the west. Wisdom, silence and death from the star in the north. And then we come to the dirge of the four cities, which again has this Celtic twilight thing about it, sort of mournful thing. Phineas and Phalias, where are they gone? Does the wave hide Murias? Does Gorias know the dawn? Does not the wind wail in the city of gems? Do not the prows sail over fallen diadems and spires of dim gold and the pale palaces of Murias, whose tale was told ere the world was old? The women cry, alas, beyond Phineus does the eagle pass, seeing but her shadow on the grass where once was Phaleas. And do her towers rise, silent and lifeless, to the frozen skies? And do whispers and sighs fill the twilights of Phineus with love that has not grown cold since the days of old? Hark to the tolling of bells and the crying of wind, the old spells, time out of mind. They are crying before me and behind. I know no more now of my pain, but am as the wandering rain, or as the wind's shadow on the grass, beyond Phineus of the dark rose, or mid the pinnacles and still snows, or the silence of Phaleas I go, or am as the wave that idly flows, where the pale wind, pale weed, in songless thickets grows, over the towers and the fallen palaces, where the sea city was, the city of Murias. And now we come to Phineus. In the torchless city of Phineus that flames on the brow of the south, the spear that divides the heart is held in a brazen mouth. Arias the flame-white keeps it, he whose laughter is heard, whenever a man has wandered, whenever a god has stirred. High kings have sought it, great queens have sought it, poets have dreamed, and ever louder and louder the flame-white laughter of Arias streamed. For kingdoms shaken and queens forsaken, and high hopes starved in their drouth, these are the torches ablaze of the walls of Phineus that lightens the south. Forbear, O Arius, forbear, lift not the dreadful spear. I had but dreamed of thee, Phineus, and Phineus, now I am stricken, now I am here. Phaleas. In the frost-grown city of Phaleas, lit by the falling stars, I have seen the ravens flying like banners of old walls. I have seen the snow-white ravens amid the ice-green spires, seeking the long-lost havens of all old lost desires. O winged desire unbroken, once nested in my heart, canst thou there give a token that even now thou art? From a bitter war defeated, thou too hast flight afar, when all my joy was cheated ere the set of the morning star. Call loud, O ancient Morias, who dwells in this place. Tell me if lost in Phaleas my old desire has grace. If now a snow-white raven it haunts the silent spires for the old impossible haven amid the old auroral fires. Gorias. In Gorias are gems and pale gold, shining diadems gathered of old from the long fragrant hair of dead beautiful queens. There the reaper gleans vast opals of white air. The dawn leans upon emerald there out of the dust of kings. The sunrise lifts a cloud of shimmering wings. In Gorias of the East my love was born, Arias dowered with a sword and all the treasures of the morn. But now all the red gems and the pale gold are as the temple trampled diadems of the queens of old, in Gorias the pale gold. Have I once heard the least breath again? No, my love is no more fain of Gorias of the East. Arias has sheathed this sword long, long ago. My heart is old, though in Gorias are gems and pale gold. Murias. In the sunken city of Murias a golden image dwells. The sea-song of the trampling waves is as muffled bells where he dwells in the city of Murias. In the sunken city of Murias a golden image gleams. The loud noise of the moving seas is as woven beams where he dreams in the city of Murias. In the sunken city of Murias, deep, deep beneath the sea, the image sits and hears time break, the heart I gave to thee and thou to me, in the city of Murias. In the city of Murias, long, oh so long ago, our souls were wed when the world was young. Are we old now that we know this silent woe in the city of Murias? In the sunken city of Murias, The sound of our little sobbing prayer is as muffled bells where he dwells in the city of Murius. And then finally the mystic's prayer. Lay me to sleep in sheltering flame, O master of the hidden fire. Wash pure my heart and cleanse from me my soul's desire. In flame of sunrise bathe my mind, O master of the hidden fire, that when I wake clear-eyed may be my soul's desire. Now, those poems, of course, are an elegy and a lament, but they're also a recreation. We hear within it some of the names of the teachers of those cities that are being called out to. Some of the names are slightly different, but they're the same figures. And so the speaking of the poem, the reading of the poem, the contemplation of some of the elements of those poems already start to evoke the presence of the cities. So while it's a lament, it's also an invocation of bringing time lost into time present. And when we come then into this, the title of this play, which is The Immortal Hour. Now there, even in the title of that, what's brought together is the idea of mortality and immortality. So if we think of an immortal hour, we think of an hour as the passage of the hours, but if we think of a mortal hour, we think of that sense of the eternal present. So we, in a sense, and even the title of this play really brings together the sense of the human, the she, the human and the elf. So it starts really to kind of already in the very first title. And we've got these kind of these figures really of the High King of Ireland, a fairy princess called Etain, a fairy prince, and the mysterious figure of Delua, and then these two figures, this male and female figure, who live just next to a great abyss in a small hut. Now what we're given this imaginal scene at the beginning of a forest glade at the rising of the moon, and in the background is a hazel shadowed pool in a wide waste of water. Now this is the pool where you find the brown trout, the rainbow trout, and this is the pool where the hazelnut fall. And as the moonshine also falls upon an ancient oak on the right-hand side, where the figure of Delua, the fairy fool, is seen leaning against the oak. He's clad in black with a small black cap from which hangs a black hawk's feather. And we're given then this image of him emerging, really, out of the out of eternity, out of the shadow, out of the mystery. And he's talking about endless time, ancient time. And suddenly we're told, you have these voices that say, infinite time, though you've travelled from one darkness to another, you've come no further than a rood, a cross, a little cross of ground woven in a circle. So we're given this image of the circled cross that is this kind of pattern, underneath pattern, that is connected to the idea of the bringing of the human and the she together. And this play is all to do with really the separation of human and she, and things not being in their right place, things being displaced. And so the sense of we have this figure of the kind of, and if we think of it on the tree of life, it's the, just next to this, there is a great abyss on the other side of the, and so we have Delua on the kind of supernal end of the, from the non-dual world, leaning out on a bow, leaning out across the abyss, and then encountering various figures, but reaching them first of all, just, and there's a powerful thing where he touches them with the shadow of his hand. And there's a lot in this play about forgetfulness and remembrance, awareness and absence of awareness. And there's a whole, but before we get into the activity of the play properly, there's a sort of beginning where we're told about the mechanics. So he talks about, you know, you've come a little way, you think so far. And he replies with, If I tread the long continuous way within a narrow round, not thinking it long, and fare a single hour, thinking it many days, I am not the first or last of the immortal clan, for whom the long ways of the world are brief, and the short ways heavy with unimagined time. So here again we're dealing with the opposites of immortality and mortality, and this sense of time as a dimension that can stretch endlessly or that can feel extraordinarily brief. And those of us who are older certainly understand how time has speeded up as we've got older. And then we get this whole kind of further on description how he's led by visions, and then he's looking out from this kind of place of stillness and looking at the sense of the world, moving the world of chariot wheels, which really evokes something really of the Christian of the Judaic creation story, where the sense of the ofanim, the energy of that moves the world, like the chariot of Ezekiel, of turning and creating the kind of world. And he talks about where the swung world roars down the starry ways, or where the uplifted grain and wind are one. So the energy that moves the world is one with the experience of planting and the reaping and threshing. So you get very concentrated, it's like a very concentrated piece of work. So in that, he's showing us the whole kind of movement of the world. And here is this figure who's, in a certain sense, sitting in Bina, sitting in a place of understanding, really looking into the particularity of the moving and the creative universe.
I'm sorry, I'm getting really mixed up with the minutiae of this.
Yeah.
Now. So I wanted one thing that sort of confused me since I saw the performance, actually. Is it? Deloitte, he is a trickster figure, isn't he? Is he a trickster sort of shadow figure from the fairy thing? Because it's not a happy story, is it? It's a story of...
Oh, it's a profoundly happy story. No, it's misunderstood. It looks like an unhappy story. It's a story of reunion.
Right.
So actually he appears like everything is reversed in it, though.
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't know how they presented it because I didn't see the performance.
Don't you have ever come to grips with it?
No. Well, no. It's a story that's opposite from the way we'll come back to it because we'll get to the end of it in the next half an hour. Right. No, not at all, Penny. But it's good that you raise that because it looks like it's a very unhappy story, but it's actually a story of restitution and healing. Because he is this kind of figure looking out of the non-dual world into the world, into the kind of world of movement, and he is, you know, what we're shown as we can, as he looks into this, we then start to see that the appearance of the kind of the gods, the goddesses. You get a whole thing about the gods and the goddesses appearing. And then we get these figures who are your names: Orchil, who's the weaver goddess, or Angus, who's the keeper of the four great keys; Dagda, the lord of thunder; Anna, the mother of the gods; Mananan of the innumerable waters; Moon crowned Brigid of the undying flame; Midir of the dune. And Midir is one of the figures who turns up in. So Midir of the dew and the evening star is one of the figures who turns up in the later, in the second act of the story. And then we're shown Angus, the keeper of the east, of birth, of song; keeper of the south, of passion and war; the keeper of the west, of sorrow and dreams; the keeper of the north, of death, of life; keeper of the four hallows. So Angus here, who is the ever young, who is the keeper of the four keys, the keepers of the hallows. Yet one more ancient, even though, than the god of the sun, and flame-haired Angus, lord of love and death, holds the last dreadful key, oblivion. And this is the movement into the non-dual. And in a certain sense, Delua is this figure. He is the figure, really, kind of, I am more old, more ancient than the gods. I am son of shadow, eldest god, who dreamed the passionate and terrible dreams. We have called fire and light, water and wind, air, darkness, death, change, decay and birth, and all the infinite bitter range that is. So he's speaking really out of, he is before the gods. He's speaking out of that much kind of deeper place. So he's not the kind of trickster figure we normally think of. This is this kind of quite kind of cosmic sort of figure, really. Mm-hmm. And who is a shadow figure, because he is the opposite. He's the apparent non-being to all the world, all that's substantial. But he is the ground from which everything substantial comes. He has called all this into being, and now he is stretching forward from the non-dual place, and he is kind of looking into the world. And what he notices is the figure of Etain, this fairy princess who is a lost princess, and so he's looking into the nature of lostness. And the Etain is not in her own country. She's left her own country, and so we say, and she's like the fairy being who is entering into mortality. Mm. So she is really seeking, an union in a certain sense with the human, but who. Doesn't know, and so we're looking at it from a different perspective, and we get this thing: fair as the moonlight and fair the woods, but not so fair as the place I come from. Why did I leave it, the beautiful country, where death is only a drifting shadow? O face of love, of dream and longing, there is sorrow upon me that I am here. I will go back to the country of the young and see again the lances of the she, as they keep hosting with laughing cries in pale places under the moon. And then she hears a peculiar cry in the wood, and she says, none made that cry who have not known the she. And then Delua appears. Hail, daughter of kings and star among the dreams, which are the lives and souls of whom have won the country of the young. And she goes on to say, I don't know who you are. I think you're one of those who have not kept the bitter honey of mortality, but are among the deathless folks. He says, I didn't respond to that. I have come far, led here by dreams and visions. And she said, well, I've come here by dreams and visions as well. And I don't know why I'm here at this grey and lonely loch. And he touches her lightly with the shadow of his hand. Have you forgotten the delicate smiling land beneath the arcs which day and night unmomently are wove between its peaceful shores and the vast gulf of dreadful silence and the unpathwayed dark, which is the deeper place beyond the world of the she? She says, well, if I remember, more is lost. If I come here to meet with you, whose name I do not know, whose face is strange. Delua, can you remember? I have forgotten all. I can remember nothing. And so then she really starts to go into a deeper sense of unconsciousness. But all she knows is that I am Etain, the white of the wave. Etain come hither from the lovely land where the immortal she fill up their lives. And Delua says somberly, how knew you not once were the unsettling moon, the grassy elf mounds filled with drowsy gold? I kissed your shadowy lips beneath the thorn, heavy with the old foam of changeless blossom. So he is saying, so you came out of the non-dual place, the place of mystery. You've descended into the inner world, but you've lost the root of that, the place that exists beyond. She goes on to say, you loved me once, I have no memory. And then what he does is that he then takes her into a deeper kind of not knowing. I'm paraphrasing her because we haven't got a lot of time. And so there's a dialogue that goes on between them. And then he says to her, a king of man has wooed the immortal hour. So this is a human king who is seeking that union. She is seeking an union. She doesn't know what she's seeking. He seeks to know the joy that is more great than joy. The beauty of the old green earth can give, he has known dreams, and because bitter dreams have been sweeter than honey, he has sought the open road that lids mid the leaves lies among shadowy things. He has sought and found and called upon the she to lead his love to one more beautiful than any mortal maid, so fair that he shall know a joy beyond all mortal joy, and stand silent and rapt beside the gate, the rainbow gate of her whom none may find, the beauty of all beauty. So the search really is for the beauty of all beauty. And she says, can this be? He says, nay, but he doesn't know the end. There's only one end to that gate. It is not love aflame with all desire, but love at peace. And this powerful phrase, love at peace.
30 seconds.
Sure. It is a bit like that, isn't it? This is the P. This is the P. We're waiting for Penny. We're just waiting for Penny to come back. So we're just all paused. So I'm being like the kind of. Yeah, exactly. It is exactly like that. She'll be back in a mo.
Here she comes.
Here she comes.
Time's almost up.
Okay. So what he says there is only one way to that gate, to the beauty of all beauty. Not love aflame with all desire, but love at peace. Again, this sense of the opposites coming together. And she asks who this king is, and Delora says he's led here by dreams and visions. And he has said, when you are won by love and adoration, you are the star of dreams, and take sweet mortal clay, and have forgotten the love-sweet whisper of the king of the she, and even as now you hear Midir's name unmoved, when you are won thus, and none know, nor any of your kindred, whence unknown, all unknowing you have come, for you, the wayward thistledown of fate shall blow on the same wind, the doom of him who blindfold seeks you. And she says, but he may not love. Yes, he shall love, says Dalua. Upon him I shall lay my touch, the touch of him that men dread and call the Amundvu, the dark one, the fairy fool. He shall have madness even as he wills and think it wisdom. I shall be his thought, a dream within a dream, the flame within, the white moths of his thought shall rise and die. So you can see that she is going to descend into the human world. The king is going to meet her. There is a kind of a binding that's happening upon them both. That Dalua is weaving for them both. That leads really to the place of the vision of the beauty beyond all beauty. And he touches her with the shadow of his hand and whispers in her ear. We don't know what he whispers, but she becomes bewildered, and she's still longing for the country of the young, and she wants to see the city of the she. And then she kind of vanishes off the scene, and the next thing we see is the king in his leathern hunting dress with a helmet surmounted by a dragon. And the Dalua says, the king is welcome here. And he says, well, how do you know I'm a king? And he says, why are you here? And the king says, I'm weary of wars and idle strife. And he's seeking something more. And then there's Dalua tells something about himself. And he says, I haven't heard that name, yet in dreams I've known one waved a shadowy plume, and smiling said, I am Dalua. Speak, I use this same Dalua. The Lord didn't answer again. I have come to this lone wood and to this lonely mere to drink from the fountain of all dreams, the shadowy font of beauty. And then the king replies eagerly, at last, the fount of beauty, fountain of all dreams. Now I've come upon my long desire. If you could show me this immortal fount, whatever you will is there, is yours. And the Lord says, you are the king, and know now whence you come and to what end. The king, and he touches him. The king, what king? And because he touches him, his awareness is taken away. You are the king of shadows. I am no king. Whither now and whence? I'm not come from any place I know, and I go where dreams and vision leads me. And suddenly a fountain rises in the mirror, like a spray rising high in the moonlight. And he looks for it, but he can't see it until Delua plucks a branch from mountain ash, waving it before his face. He says, I see a fountain, and within it its shadow, a great fish swims, and on the moveless wave the scarlet berries float, and dim within the depths the face of one I see, most calm and great, august with mournful eyes. Ask what you will. The word of wisdom, or you hidden God, show me my star of dreams, show me the way. He offers him then a way of going.
Request that he has to make.
He makes that request, show him the way. And there's then a dialogue between them, but he's offered the chance of going backwards, but no, he goes forward. And Delua then leads him forward. And then we come into, suddenly, the scene shifts, and we're in a hut at the other side of the abyss with these two figures, these two peasant figures of Manus and Maeve. And there's a whole kind of dialogue. And these are almost like the two archetypal human beings, a version of Adam and Eve. So then we're suddenly in the beginnings of human beings.
So do they just witness?
Well, in a certain sense, what's happening there is this dialogue that's been happening outside the world and now starts to happen then within the world and within the conditions, within the hut of Adam and Eve, we could say, right? And within the place of that, to use slightly different language. And what happens here then is there's a whole kind of, there's a whole dialogue about wind and weather and kind of sheltering and the creating of a shelter, creating of an archetypal place. And then the figure of Etain comes into this place, and there's a whole lot of dialogue between the archetypal man and woman with Etain, and then later the king appears, and they sit together really before the fire, and then there's a whole kind of a dialogue then that happens around grey feathers and blind eyes, which are the wind and the rain, water and wind, around a fire. So we've got this sense of the primal gods, the primal kind of elements. And here they offer shelter them to both. And then there is a connection made between the king and Etain. And there's a phrase, he calls her, he falls in love with her, to call you love, to take you hence, my queen, queen of my heart, my queen, my dream, my queen. And she looks into his face with thrown back head. I too am lifted with the breath of a tumultuous wind. I too am lit with fire which fills my heart. My lord, my king, my lord, my king, my lord, my king. And so there's a sort of union that happens between them, which is an union really that about them coming really into the world of manifestation. But there's a little click bit at the end where Etain, even as she goes with him, sings the song of how beautiful they are, the lordly ones who dwell in the hills, in the hollow hills. So there's a little thing that this is not the end of the song. That's the end of Act One. So Act Two. Okay, I've just got enough time to do enough for this, so we get some of it. So Act Two. We're a year later. We're in the hall of the royal den of Tara. And we get the bards praising the king and praising the queen, and the And then the queen is where she says she's wary. She's got some strange, perplexing dreams. And he tries to persuade her to stay with him, but no, she says she's going to needs to follow her dreams. He's like, I see grey delicate shadows on the grass, grey shadows on the fern, swift and flitting like foam shadows before the grey wave of the coming day. But I am weary. Yothe, eleven kings, sweet sleep and sweeter dreams. And everybody then salutes the queen. And then what happens is a figure of Midir, who is the fairy prince, appears. So then a figure out of fairy appears, tells us he is a king's first son, but he's under a sacred bond to tell no one, even to the king, his name and lineage. King, I wish you well, lordship and peace, and all your heart's desire. And then there's a whole process that goes on about looking at the interrelationship between the country of the summer stars and the human world. And they then play a game on the chessboard that Midir has brought with him, a beautiful chessboard from the inner worlds. And so it's quite a lot of beautiful stuff that happens, which we look at again in another thing. And he says, "O king, it is a little," and he wins, basically. "It's a little thing. I ask only that I may touch with my own lips the white hand of the queen, that sweet attain which you love so well, and that you should listen to a distant shell's sweet song, a little echoing song that I have made, down by the foam on sea-drowned shores, to please her lovelier beauty." And he doesn't want to wake the queen up, but he does, and she says, "Oh, I couldn't sleep anyway. My dreams kept me awake. I was dim and silent as the grass until a faint wind moved over me, and dews gathered, and in the myriad little bells I saw a myriad stars." He goes on to say, "This lord has won a boon from me." And then she looks long and lingeringly at Midir, gives him a hand, and then when he raises it to her lips, bowing, and lets it go, she starts, and looks very bewildered, and looks fixedly. And then he sings the song that's the final song of the last act, "How beautiful they are, the lordly ones." And then you see her starting to wake up. And he then sings a song that's an invocation of the heart's desire. "I am a song in the land of the young, a sweet song. I am love, I am a bard, with white wings and a breast of flame, singing, singing. The wind sways me on the quickened bough. Hark, I hear laughter among the nuts on the hazel tree. I sing to the salmon in the fairy pool. What is the dream the salmon dreams in the pool of Connla under the hazels? It is, there is no death, Medea, with thee, in the honey-sweet land of land's desire. It is a name wonderful, Medea, love. It was born on the lips of Angus Og. Go look for it, lost name, beautiful, strayed from the honey-sweet land of youth. I am Medea, love, but where is my secret name in the land of heart's desire? I am a bird with white wings and a breast of flame, singing, singing. The salmon of knowledge hears and whispers, look for it, Medea, in the heart of Etain. Etain, Etain, my heart's desire, love, 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 sorrow, sorrow. And she says, I am a small green leaf in the great wood, and you are the wind of the south. And then Eochaf is unhappy about this, and but he realizes that this is the feast of Samhain. All is dark that has been light. And he says, come back, you are slipping away. She says, I cannot hear your voice so far away. Wherefore I have come, the light is gone, farewell. And he says, come back, it is just a dream that calls. So he's very sad, because she is returning back into her own place. And he is drawn with her. And Medea is also drawing attain to him. So there's a movement, really, that is the union of the worlds, and the sort of, increasingly now we get an invocation of the fairy worlds and the sense of the the sense of the kind of the union of those worlds, but it's like the human world now is being taken into, and Etain and Medea together are taking and leading the king also into the fairy world, and Etain. And the union between Etain and Medea is the union really before falling into unconsciousness. And there is a sense really that what happens towards the kind of right at the end of the play, which can feel like poor old King left behind. Because she goes away with him, and sort of, and there's a sense of union really between the masculine and feminine, the opposites of the son and the daughter of life. And the king says, suddenly encounters, this is the same Dalua who I met long since in that grey and shadowy wood, about the verge of the old broken earth, where at the last moss-clad it hangs in cloud. I am come. My dreams, he'd given me my dreams. There is none left but this, the dream of death. Now all of that stuff that has happened in the year, the cycle of the year, has happened within that framed conversation between Dalua and the king. And what's happened, that the king has witnessed and lived through and experienced, is the union of human and fairy, and then has been taken, and this death in a sense is his initiation into the mystery of Dalua, which is the mystery beyond the opposites. And so it's we'll come back to this play, because there's a lot more in it than
they find
possibly
search for the beauty
of the heart desire. So if we think of that bit of Levitt piece and that whole kind of quest for the beauty of beauty, which is the place that he was looking for, and then it's as if he goes into this dream place of being for a year, for an entire year, which is the cycle of a whole kind of cycle of time, of living with Etain, of living, if you like, with the sense of the beauty that's in the having come to live with him in that kind of world. Then the next turning of that cycle is that that lost beauty returns to her own place. And he is drawn with it, and the whole of that world is drawn with him into the conversation with Dalua. So the whole thing has been the conversation between Dalua and the king, with lots of magical keys kind of in dotted all through that. So there's a whole way in which this particular drama holds so much of the things that you find scattered through Fiona MacLeod's work, which is why it's so powerful. And it looks like it's a sort of sad story of the kind of lostness and it's all gone, and poor old king's left on his own, so he had nothing left but to do is die. But this is the death of initiation rather than the death of despair.
I hesitate to say something that might just show up the fact I really don't understand, but I've got to say this because it seems so obvious to me that there's a real resonance with the Puch and Araun whole conversation, year in another place, the fact that Puch doesn't actually sleep with the goddess of the place and that sort of thing, and returns, but the fact that even though he doesn't, it makes a relationship between the two worlds.
Two worlds, yes, that's right.
Enriches both of them.
Yes, that's right. No, there's a lot of similarities really between these quite different kind of stories, and sort of it's because in both places we look at the union of the worlds.
Yeah.
But what he's done here very cleverly, in a way, is take us also. So Dalua brings in this world of the beyond, even the world of fairy. So we get this figure that doesn't turn up in any mythology we know about, of this figure who is beyond the abyss, who sets it all going. And kind of, and who is this? And this interesting son of shadow, older than the gods, and who brings the death that is initiation. And really, this is thinking on the tree of life. This is the initiation that comes into art, where we kind of go beyond all the known things into the unknown. by returning to the beginning, and this interesting kind of process whereby, as this, the desire of the king, the lostness of the king, they enter first of all into that hut to the edge of the abyss, which is the world of Adam and Eve. They meet each other, and so if you like, the fairy and the human meet each other, and then enter really into the, if you like, into the world of humanity, the world of the Celtic time at that world, the ordinary world at that time, really. But there is still within that, there is this missing piece, because this sense of, while she loves the king and she's drawn into flesh, drawn into matter, he is experiencing something of the beauty of the world through her. There's a missing piece, and that missing piece is provided by Midia, who is the power of kind of love at peace, who descends and finds the lost soul, the lost part of his soul. And they finds her, and so the worlds are balanced again. And then there's a further balancing, because the king, who is the deserted king, is whom we think is going to be lost, suddenly comes to, and he's talking to Delua, and he's suddenly back with that question of the beauty of all beauty, and then he enters into death, which is the death of initiation. So it's subtle, very subtle, and a lot going on in it, really.
Like that central piece, like the immortal hour occurring within the center, and he does an entire cycle to come back into the center.
That's right. That's right.
Very different than the Aran and
Yes, that's right. So the difference here, really, the difference somewhere here is he returns to the centre in a way that Poich doesn't in that story. And so the story of Poich and around moves through the different ways through the four branches and is concluded in the fifth in the fourth branch, really, right into that centerboard place. Now in this story, that doesn't happen. The king returns, is somehow held within that and returns back to the place of the beginning.
Same
somewhere.
Completes the journey
But you see in it this kind of fractal element of things nested within other things, right? So that's the kind of the complicated thing in it somewhere.
It also seems like the big difference is that the king expresses his desire for the beauty.
Yes.
He steals the stag, he's on a hunt.
Yes, that's right, exactly. Yes, exactly.
He doesn't have a consciousness to say, I'm hunting this.
No, completely. That's right.
And then he steals it.
No, this king, in fact, low, he's weary of life, he knows what he's looking for, he's searching for, he asks out, he reaches out, he's therefore available to be met in a way that Poich is not somewhere, really. So, yeah.
That's tremendously helpful.
So that was like a real whistle stop towards it. We'll come back to it. We're just at the end of our time, so let's just kind of let's just spend a moment and just close this bit off.